Save big money when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior wood stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture. It repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Our knowledgeable team is ready to help bring your dreams to life, 1 gallon at a time. Stop by your local Menards today. Save big.
Hello and welcome to Raising a Pro. I'm Annie Apple, journalist and NFL mom to my son, Eli Apple. My NFL mommy mentor is on the show today. That's right, Sandra Atkins, mother to Cincinnati Bengals Pro Bowl defensive tackle, Geno Atkins. I love this woman because she's a truth teller. She doesn't mince words. And when I need someone to school me on the, you know, ins and outs of NFL life, Sandra Atkins is that girl. She's a valuable resource, a wealth of knowledge and wisdom, and when you need her to be, she's a road dog of support and encouragement. The last time you and I saw each other was last January. We went to the funeral of Bryce Gowdy, the young man out in Florida who, he played football, he was committed to go to Georgia Tech, and he took his life, and I really felt the need that as NFL mom that we should really go to the funeral and kind of and support his mom and just be there. I just felt like we needed to be there. So that was the last time we saw each other. And it was just a year later, I think about a week ago, that his mom, they commemorated the 1 year of laying him to rest. What do you remember about that when we went out to that together?
That was just an emotional moment, Annie. And at that school, Deerfield Beach High School, it's in a predominantly African-American community. We had another two students after Bryce that committed suicide. So the school was really, you know, going through at the time, the student body. And then they went into lockdown. We had the corona that came on in March. So I'm not sure if those kids even got the help that they needed. But just to see the effects of what happened in that community, but it was something going on at that in that area where definitely some mental health counseling or something needed to go on to help those families that were struggling. And basically that's what it was. The family struggled, therefore the kids are struggling.
And when it comes to mental health, that is such a huge struggle because it's not something you can often see. Having your child battle that, and I think there is an article in the Washington Post that sheds more light on that story a year later. In it, the mom talks about concussion and how it may have contributed to his suicidal thoughts. But anyway, at the time we went there, we just wanted to be supportive. And it was touching. It was sad. And then Corona came. In the beginning, we called it Corona. But it's COVID-19. It's pandemic. Or as Mama Bettis call it, the pandemic. I feel like we're going to be in this pandemic for like 12 years. So let's get used to it. Speaking of that, let's get to Geno. He's been in this league 11 years with the same team. What do you think is his secret to longevity?
He didn't start playing football really early. So he, you know, his body didn't get beat up early on. He started playing football actually in ninth grade. And, you know, I would advocate, you know, a lot of times I see the little 6-year-olds out there, 7-year-olds in pad, and they were hitting. And I was like, why? You know, put these kids in track and field. You know, you need to be fast for whatever you're going to do. Let them do some of the other sports and football can come later on. And just being with the Bengals, you know, the ceiling for the Bengals were not very high. So you could survive on the Bengals for a long time.
Tell us the truth, Sandra.
I'm telling the truth. You can survive on the Bengals for a while. You know, so they major in mediocrity. That's just my term. You know, we try to get better, but I don't think there's anybody there at the top that actually have excellence in mind. That's just my take on it.
Sandra will never lie to you. Okay.
Never.
So let's get to the beginning. His father played with the Saints and the Dolphins, is it?
Yes. He was a 10-year. We made it to the 10th year. So that was even long for his. He came from HBCU, from Florida A&M. He was a 7th round in the 12th-round draft at that time. And so for HBCU guy to play that long, that was, you know, amazing.
And he was a safety.
He was a safety. He played strong safety with the Saints. And I think when he got to the Dolphins, that he played a couple of years at free safety. We met in college. That's what my freshman professor of English told us. Ladies, leave here with your husbands. It's hard out there. Ooh, and I tell any freshman girl that when you get on campus, the little freshman boys, they won't look real good to you right now. But when they're seniors, trust me.
Leave here with a degree and a husband. You know what? That's a great recruiting line. Get you a degree in accounting. And a man that can make some money.
That's right.
Okay, so you guys met HBCU. Now, let's talk about HBCU and NFL. It's not a... There's like a few guys that come out of HBCU that make it out in the league.
Yeah, it's gotten a lot better now. And we have Coach Prime that's at Jackson State. And Deion Sanders is the new head coach at Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi. And that's in the SWAC conference. So he is really bringing a lot of attention to the HBCUs. HBCUs. And so we'll take it. And, you know, we have to take everything that comes with Prime. And so, I think we're doing, they're getting ready right now to do a lot of, you know, he's seeing the disparities in how, you know, equipment and facilities and things like that. And so what an article that was done about, I read it about the end of last year, and they talked about, you know, how the SEC and the ACC and all these big conferences, they actually owe the HBCU. They should be putting some money in a pot and giving it to these schools, because in the 60s, the guys, most of the professional athletes that were black came from HBCUs. It had South Carolina State that have 3 Hall of Famers because they could not go to these other schools. Once they started accepting the players, you know, letting the players come, then they, instead of, you know, inviting the teams to be a part of their league, they just said, you know, just kind of pushed them to the side and said, okay, we're going to, you know, because at Florida A&M could have played with Florida State, and they probably would have beat Florida State because they had most players. Florida State may have had 2 or 3 black players at the time, but instead of inviting them to join into the league, which would have kept the HBCUs on par in recruiting, they said, no, we're going to form our own. Yeah, and the monies. They would have been able to do that. So they really, you know, something has to be done with these major leagues that kind of, you know, pilgrim our guys and said, hey, you can make it if you're here. And so I think we, even in the political arena, and when you go to school, they tell you, oh, no, you need to go to here. I'm in Florida, University of Florida, Florida State. You know, if you're, you know, your degree is not going to be worth as much. And I said, BS. I look at the state of our country right now. Kamala is from Howard University, our vice president, HBCU. You know, we went through and we said our new congressman out of Georgia, he's a Morehouse guy. So, you know, you go to an HBCU, you not only get an education in book sense, but you also get your culture, and you get so many people that care about you. The professors care about you making it out of there and making something of yourself. And so that was the difference just going.
And it's also kind of great to be around people often that, you know, in the same community where you're able to kind of rise, you know, where you feel like, you know, you are among kinfolks sometimes. So that usually, especially because I know Eli went to Ohio State, it's predominantly white. And often there, I feel like they're isolated. Like I always say, the boys didn't even discover the Hale Center, which is like, the, you know, is African-American center and has more African-American artifacts rather than any other university. And the kids, the boys didn't even know it existed on campus till I started throwing events there after games.
Wow.
For families. So I'm just saying, it's just really great, especially now what we're looking at, to really know your history, to really know how people who look like you built and contributed to the foundation and the economic success of this country. So anyway, but Gino ended up going to Thomas Aquinas High School. That's like a football school, right? Like everybody and their mama went there, right?
It's a football powerhouse. If you're in South Florida, it's one of them. They have a couple. When we were thinking about schools, I actually live about 30 minutes west of the school. And the school in our neighborhood, I looked at, you know, what they were doing, because this was going to be his first year playing football. And I said, no, you can't go there. You're not going to learn anything. And I actually had to go and talk to the coach at St. Thomas Aquinas, because we're not in the neighborhood. They're a private Catholic school. And he said, bring him on out. Let me see him. And so Gino at the time, he grew really quick. He was like 6 foot tall at that point.
Wow. At age 14?
Yeah. And so he only grew another. So they actually put him on the offensive line because he was big. Had a little pudgy stomach. And so he played O-line his freshman year. And then he was like, I don't like this. I said, well, if you want to get off the O-line, get in the weight room. And that summer, he went into the weight room after his freshman year. And he came out a linebacker. He was chiseled.
What's his secret? Because right now I am in O-line shape and I need to come out of this pandemic as a linebacker. Okay.
Linebacker, girl, you got to hit that weight room. And he really did. And so he played linebacker his sophomore and junior year. And then at the end of his junior year, he shot up maybe another foot. And I looked at him, I said, how much do you weigh? He said, 275. I said, well, son, there is no 275 linebackers anywhere. They're going to put you on the line. And so he says, yeah, probably. And so when he went to they have summer ball. I mean, they do ball all year round at St. Thomas. There's spring ball, then there's summer, then you play in the fall, and really? It just rolls around again. Oh, yeah. So he went in there, and they put him on the line, and they put him at the end because he could rush the pass. A linebacker, he was rushing the quarterback, so they put him at defensive end. And thank God for him, when he was being recruited, he didn't grade. They had him as a linebacker because, you know, you get recruited. A lot of parents don't realize whatever you're doing your junior year, that's that important year to get recruited. Your senior year, you're you know, player people already coming, you know, and wanting to talk to you by the time you're a senior. And so the University of Georgia came in late, and because they had him graded lower at a linebacker, but they had him graded higher. And so he did his 5 visits. At the time, parents couldn't go on the visit, so I had to pack him up and send him off by himself.
Isn't that crazy? I can't even believe that was a thing back then. You have a minor child traveling across the country, and they are not allowed to take a parent.
And they had cheerleaders picking them up, and they had, you know, the guys taking them all over the place. So it was the Wild Wild West back then.
Now it's just a secret Wild Wild West. It's Wild Wild West, but it's low key. There's a passcode,
you know,
to the Wild Wild West.
It's a passcode, right. So, you know, he went in, and thank God for Coach Gardner, the defensive line coach at Georgia, looked at him and said, I don't think you're going to grow much taller. I'm going to put you at defensive tackle, because the ends are usually 6'4", lanky guys. You know, they're the taller guys that play on the end. The stubby guys play in the middle. So
stubby. Said, I'm going to put you. Why you call them stubby? Yeah.
They're stubby. They're all stubby. Sue, all of them. Jerry McCoy. They're all stubby. So I told him, I said, okay, well, defensive tackle. So I was like, we got to figure out what the tackle does. He said, don't worry. Keep doing exactly what you're doing. We're going to use your speed at tackle, which is, at the time, the tackle would basically just, you know, stop the run. They didn't rush the pass so much. So he kind of changed the game for the tackle. I mean, Aaron Donald, that's right now one of the premier D linemen, would have never been drafted as high if Gino did not have the success that he had at his height. He's 6'2". And, you know, he played at 293, not the 300-plus-pound big guy that's in the middle, clogging up the middle. The ends would push, and the pocket, the quarterback would step up into the pocket. Well, the D-tackle, they changed the game, because now you can't step up because that middle guy is coming up rushing also. That middle D-tackle can also get to the quarterback. And so that's what you see now, that those guys in the middle, the tackles, became a thing.
Aaron Donald, I think, is like the best player in the NFL. Like, I'm just a huge Aaron Donald fan. I love watching him play. It's like a dance. He's just
He's so quick, and you see it's the quickness.
He's smooth, yeah. And he's like, he's determined, and he always gets what he wants. That determination, you can tell. So Aaron Donald needs to send Gino a thank you package.
Just a little something.
But there are two athletes. But you raised two athletes, though. Let's not leave your daughter out. I want to give her shout out, too.
Oh, yeah. My daughter, she's actually at University of New Orleans right now doing her master's, and she's a track and field athlete. She's a shot put and discus. And she played basketball in high school.
Put some respect on her name. Let's shout her out.
She kept getting hurt. And so I said, basketball does not love you. you love basketball, but it doesn't love you. So let's, you're being injured. She had a knee injury, then she had the broken toe or foot. So it was just one thing after another. So she ended up getting a scholarship in track and field, which was, her thing.
So now let's go to Gino's recruiting. He ended up choosing Georgia. Why didn't he choose the HBCU?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I actually got on my alma mater about. They didn't even send us a postcard. I was like, people are sending letters and books and everything. Y'all didn't even send a postcard. And sometimes, they said, well, they know that the top athletes are not going to choose them.
But that's not the point. That's not the point. You got to still ask. Give me the opportunity to say no, but at least ask.
Yeah. So that's what I told him. I said, you never know. Some of these guys, may want to go, but you didn't even send us a postcard. We didn't even get anything from anybody at A&M, which was, what? Really?
That's crazy. It's like a short guy. No, I don't like short men. But at least ask. You may catch me in a day where I want my ankle scratched. You know what I mean? You never know.
Oh my God. I'm never gonna have one of those days. I'm 5'9", so the short men need not apply. I can't.
You know what I mean? You might catch me on a day where the pandemic's getting to me. And I might be like, okay, I'll let you scratch my ashy ankle. You never know.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so he chose Georgia. And what was that like for him?
They could go to 5 places. And so we lived in Florida. Like I said, I'm at the bottom of Florida. So anywhere we go is far. To get out of the state of Florida, you got to drive 7 hours. That's just the way it is from where I am. So he went to Michigan. He visited Michigan. And there was, Michigan State. And then he did somewhere North Carolina State. He went to Auburn, Georgia. One more place. Where did he go? I don't even remember where he went. But the Hurricanes, which was in our backyard. And at
Miami,
the time, the Hurricanes were, trying to come back. They had just hired an African-American coach, Randy Shannon. And I was like, I don't know. I said, you decide where you're going. I said, pick the school where you would go if you're not playing football, because you may not be able to play football. And so he went to Georgia. He chose Georgia because they had the best dorms and the food was delicious. That's what he told me. And I said, really? He said, they're playing football everywhere. I got to sleep good.
They cooking like this everywhere.
I got to sleep good and I got to eat good. I said, okay, then Georgia it is. So there you have it.
Know,
those ladies in Georgia was cooking flank steak and rice and gravy and smothered. Everything was smothered. So, and they had just opened the new brand new dorms. That was like an apartment. He had never had a room. He has 2 sisters, so he always had his own room. So some of these other colleges had, roommates, people next to you and whatever. In Georgia, the players had their own rooms. And, they were in a 2. He was in a 2-1 his freshman year. And so that was that appealed to him. And so it was the dorm, because he had to eat good and sleep good. That was his criteria.
Go to Florida A&M. You leave there with a degree and a husband. Go to Georgia. You eat good and sleep good.
Yes, indeed. Oh, we have our priorities together in this family.
Oh, my God. He was like, but can you see yourself going to school there? Listen, I can see myself sleeping well and eating well.
Yeah, as long as he can do that, he was fine. I said, okay.
Let's talk about his freshman year at Georgia. That's when you all discovered that he had the sickle cell trait. Tell me about that.
Yes. And they did the test when he was born, because his dad has a trait. And I remember when I met him, he said, are you a trait? And I'm like, what? And not knowing what he was talking about. And he's like, are you a trait? I said, a trait of what? So he says, do you have sickle cell? I said, I don't think so. I said, no one in my family has it. I don't know. And I never went and got a blood test. I just said no. And, I could have had it, but I just said no. And so we go.
You didn't even know what it was.
I knew some people that had the disease, but didn't know that there was such thing as a trait. And so
trait, yeah.
He says, well, I have the sickle cell trait. I said, okay. And they do the test now, and all new newborns, and they I think they told us, not just told us, just kind of put it out of my mind. It's like, it doesn't mean anything, because Gene played with it and didn't have any adverse effect and, you know, whatever. So, and when he went to Georgia, because he was always, my son is always tired and always sleepy. He loves to sleep. And so at St. Thomas, I was like, why are you the last one running to the huddle? He was like, I'm tired. I was like, okay. And so it does make you tired, you know, but he gets to sleep. He will sleep. You cannot stop him from sleeping. He will sleep anywhere. And so that was one of the things that I said, oh, that's why you used to be so tired and always sleepy. And so when he went to Georgia, they did the test. And so they had one of the trainers had to watch. They assigned the trainers to the guys that had sickle cell to make sure that they weren't
stay hydrated.
You know, yeah, stay hydrated. Yeah. They weren't overexerting themselves. And so I was comfortable with it. And, you know, I said, okay, just because I remember Corey Stringer, he was one of the NFL players who played for the Vikings that actually died at practice. And the NFL was trying to say it was something else.
I remember
that. And they found out that it was sickle cell trait. And when you overexert yourself, you actually go into a sickle cell crisis, like you have the full-blown disease. And if you go to the hospital and they don't know what to do, they give you the wrong IV, they have to know what to do. And you actually die before the next day. And that's what happened to Corey. And we had a couple players at Florida State. Well, they were twins. And one of them passed away. And then we had a couple of high school players here. So it was like, wait a minute, this thing is becoming more you know, prevalent. And I think one of the players for the Pittsburgh Steelers, what was his name? Ryan? I don't remember his name, but he had actually retired.
Ryan Clark.
He retired early because of the sickle cell, you know, having symptoms and it was sickle cell. So it is something that can bother you. We haven't had any adverse effect, but like I said, Gino hydrate and he rests. You have to get your rest.
I remember recently when I talked to Jerome Bettis's mom, Gladys, the OG, she talked about how he had developed asthma. And so what she used to do is just like go wait outside of his high school practice. She would literally park her car right there just to make sure he was okay. So for you, though, were you really not concerned that, I mean, because it takes a lot of trust to trust these trainers or these coaches with the health of your child, you know, something like that, that, you know, when it comes to sickle cell, we're still learning more, right? So was there anything that was really concerned at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I sit behind the bench at all games. I buy StubHubs. I don't know who these people are. They have made hundreds of thousands of dollars off me sitting buying their $500 tickets and their $1,000 tickets, because I sit behind the defense bench because I watch him. And when he comes off the field, what does he look like? What is he doing? How is he breathing? Because the players, when they get into that mode, they will not.
They
can't say no. They can't say whatever. Yeah. So I watch him. If they go to Denver and play, I'm like, hey, his rookie year, you know, I was like, his defensive line coach almost killed him, had him out there for 10 plays. And he was done for the rest of the game. He was sitting on the sideline with oxygen because he could only play maybe 5 plays. So he could never play in Denver. That's one of the high altitude places. He would never be able to play in Denver because of the sickle cell trait. So that's one of the things that I do sit behind the bench and I do watch very, you know, carefully, because I always, you know, see my way. If I can hop over there real quick, how can I get down there before security get me? I map it all out before the game, pregame.
Well, I mean, he did well. He did really well in Georgia. Then he got drafted 2010, fourth round by the Bengals. What was that whole process like for you? Like when he was done with Georgia and ready to go in the draft, was he sad that he had to leave the food behind and the good bed? What was that? Did he want to do another year and another year?
Yeah, he actually graded out really high his junior year, but he was not ready to leave school. He was not
the food,
ready.
Those smothered pork chops, the South, the grits and the biscuits.
Listen, the girl and the bacon, I'm telling you. And so he was like, I'm not ready to go. I want to stay. I said, okay. And he came back his senior year, and the team at that point had a fifth-year quarterback that started. Matthew Stafford was our quarterback. He decided to go early. So Matthew left as a junior, and the team, you know, if your quarterback is gone, immediately went down. And so their senior year was not as good as the previous 2 years. And so when he was talking, the agents were talking to teams, and they were like, well, he's like a tweener. You know, they say you're between a linebacker and a lineman because of his height. He's not the typical, at that time, the prototype, his year, the two prototype defensive tackle was Sue and Gerald McCoy. And those are big boys. Sue is 6'4", 320. Yeah. Gerald was 6'4", God knows 200 and what. I mean, 300 and what. And so that was the standard. And here comes Gino at 6'2", 290. And so they were like, well.
Stubby.
Yeah, he's not. And that's what all the team. You know, well, so I always thank Marvin Lewis and, you know, Cincinnati Bengals for seeing something that they said, let's bring him in the fourth round. You know, leaving Georgia, he was ready at that point. He was ready to go. He was like, okay, I've done all I can do here. And the class that he came in
with, I ate all I
could
eat. I slept all I could sleep.
Yeah, when he went to Cincinnati, he was really disappointed. The food there was this Midwest, you know, it's like, okay.
Yeah. I'm surprised he didn't go to the Falcons. Like, I mean, the Falcons, they won him.
That would have been really, I don't know that what they were, you know, Falcons were doing at that time in their tenure.
But we don't know what they're still doing, honey. But go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, so from Florida to Georgia to Cincinnati. First of all, what was the draft process like for you? Did you know in advance where he was going to go? Because, I mean, defensive tackle, that's not the sexiest position.
Right. And his agent, you know, was saying, well, maybe second or third round, late second, early third round. So, you know, we were like, we knew we weren't going to do anything the first day, but we were, you know, we watched it. And so the second day now we were like, okay, you know, Friday night, we're all geared up and we're sitting around. We didn't invite any people or do any partying, that kind of stuff. I don't believe in any of that. It's just us. It was family. And then we sit there and we're watching all these defensive tackles get taken, and he killed it at the combine. I mean, he was real fast, his bench press. And I'm like, he was like, I was better than that guy at the combine. You know, that's his thought. After a while, he just stopped talking. And we're like, when he stopped talking, okay, he's a quiet, you know, Gino's not talking anymore. And then he was like, I'm going to bed. And so by third round, he goes and he lays down, and we're like, okay, we watch the rest of it. Absolutely nothing. So we get up Saturday morning, and I was like, we're going to go to my mom's house because we had planned. We used to go to the mom's house on the weekend. We're going to my mom's, we're going to grandma's. So we're packing up the car, and we're going to go to went to the seafood store to pick up some seafood because we're going to cook. We were going to do this anyway because he would have been drafted, we thought, and we're going to go to my mom's house and do the cookout thing. And I'm in my minivan, Dodge Chrysler minivan. Shout out to Dodge. That's mom's taxi. And so we drive, and we're outside. We're parked outside the store. I'm inside the store, and I see him on the phone and this grin across his face. And so my daughter, she runs in and she said, Mom, he's drafted. And so I run out of the store, leave my buggy in the store, just kind of runs out. And I was like, what? Who is it? He's like, Cincinnati Bengals. And I'm like, the Bengals? That's something to myself, because they didn't even talk to him at the combine. They didn't talk to him, had never said a word to him. He went and worked out for Tampa Bay. He worked out for a couple other teams, but nothing from the Bengals. And Marvin Lewis was on the phone. And so he hung up the phone. He was like, he's like, pick number 120, fourth round. I was like, okay, you in there. And so the conversation on the way to my mom's house, I went in and paid for my food, came back out. So the conversation.
I'm glad you paid for your food, though.
Yeah,
really
we had to go pay for the food because we're going to eat real good. And, you know, the conversation on the way to the house, well, he was like, okay, fourth round. All right, that's good. I said, well, yeah. I said, well, when you go in there, you just get in there and you do it. You show them fourth round. And I said, you just play, you know, you get in there, you just play like you haven't played before. And that's what he did his rookie year. He played in about, you know, he would go in, he was a backup. And then his second year, he was a starter. And he's been a starter ever since. So he played with a chip on his shoulder. He was like, okay, I'm going to outplay these guys, all these guys that was drafted ahead of me. And we did. So it was one of those kind of things.
Because I know at one point it was him and Tank Johnson.
Yeah, Tank was on the line with him. And that's what he said. You know, he looked and see how many guys was in front of him. You know, what does he need to do? And he is not a lazy player. And he, you know, he did whatever the coaches, his line, defensive line coach loved him. And he got his opportunity to get in there and play. And when he did, he made plays. He was really quick. Like I said, he was smaller than most of the D tacklers. So you get up onto the pads of those big slow foot offensive linemen, and you can get to the quarterback. And that's what his bread and butter was, getting to the quarterback.
So his first contract, rookie contract, was 4-year, $3.2 million. He finished his rookie season with 16 combined tackles, 10 solo, 3 sacks. I mean, he went out there, he made his mark, right? What was it like? There are not too many Black head coaches in the NFL. He was fortunate to play with one. What was it like playing for Marvin Lewis?
They loved it. I mean, Marvin treated the guys like family. It was like a family atmosphere. He really took those guys under his wings. The ones that were kind of troublesome, Marvin went out of his way over and above trying to, you know, keep them in line. He kept some guys on the team, I think, that other coaches would have cut. And once Marvin left, you saw that those guys were no longer in the league, or they went somewhere else and they were one and done, because, you know, he kind of kept them in a cocoon. He kind of kept them. He became that father figure that some of them didn't have. But it was a real family atmosphere. He ran a tight ship. His coaches, you know, it was like night and day. I mean, we have a young coach right now in Zach. And, you know, we talk about the difference. It's just the communication. Marvin could talk to them and, you know, hey, this is what it is. This is where it is. You know, Zach is more politically correct. And I guess that's just the difference in age, where the young people now, everything is positive. And you know, everything is roses. Oh, we would have won if we would have did this. Marvin's like, we lost that one today. And we gotta get better. We've gotta do this. And players, you know, think now it's the roses, you know, we're skipping through the daisies and the roses, which, you know, like I said, this is generation. Everybody's about the positivity. But I told him, I said, if you live like that, when something really adverse happened, how do you handle it? How do you know how to handle it if you you can't handle the basic things? Because negative things will happen to you in life, and it is going to happen. And you can't talk. You can't do positive talk to talk yourself out of, you know, I'm cutting, I'm bleeding. You got to go get the bandage, and you got to get it stitched up. You got to do something about it. And I think that sometimes the positive talk kind of keep you from taking action. You know, you're sitting there meditating on positivity.
Yeah, it's just about figuring out what is the problem, addressing it, attacking it, and then turning that problem into a solution. So I know Marvin is looking for a job now. So if you could give Marvin Lewis a recommendation to any owner, what would you say about him as a coach?
As a coach, like I said, Marvin had, he hires well. His assistants were hired. His, you know, his coordinator was hired away as a head coach. His defensive coordinator was hired away as a head coach. So he knows how to put a staff together. After that first wave leaves, I think it's when, you know, trying to bring in new coaches. And I think that's where he kind of ran into trouble bringing in some of those other coaches after his initial coaches were hired away as head coaches. We didn't bring in, I don't think, strong enough people to fill those shoes or to keep the train going. We had a top 10 defense with Mike Zimmer. Once Zimmer left, the defense just fell off the wagon.
To go to Minnesota.
Yeah. So Marvin is a great leader. He's a leader of men. He knows how to communicate even with the young people. He had a son that was about the age of most of the players. So he knew how to communicate with the players. And he cares for his players. He really cares for his players. He can put a scheme together. He's very trusting. He listens to his coaches. You know, and some of the times I wish he didn't. He wish he would become more of an alpha Marvin, but he's a Sigma man. He's very, you know, he moves in silence, but he is as smart as they come. He should get another shot at a head coach. I see some of the stuff that they're hiring right now, and I'm like, really?
Oh, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like I'm like, really? Where did he come from? Oh, he was a tight ends coach. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah, I look at Atlanta. You're in Hotlanta. You're in a predominantly African American town. Really? I'm like, come on, dude.
Child. You
know, yeah, let's miss Arthur Blank, you know. And a lot of these people, the people that's around the table with them, there's no diversity. So, you know, there's no one telling them the truth. I told them, they can hire me. I'll tell it to you. This is what you need to do, sir. You know, you live in an African-American town. You need an African-American coach to coach these players.
And you know what, though? I have to say this, because when people think, oh, just, you know, oh, it's about merit. I was like, of course, you don't want to put anybody there who you know you can't do the job. But the thing is, there are countless African-American coaches that will be great head coach. I personally hate this idea of, oh, we need a special internship program for Black coaches. No, you don't. Because what internship program did half of the guys who came and said Adam Gacy go? What about Freddie Kitchens? Yeah. Where did he, what was his internship program? You're hiring people straight out of college into NFL. You're hiring people who some even never been
Never been a coordinator.
So you have 70% of the league that's Black, but only two Black coaches. Yeah. Come on,
and
people.
They have to go through, they have to jump through the hoops and, you know, duck under the fence. And, you know, they got to know everything, analytics. They got to know this, they got to know that. And, you know, so.
Like Eric Bieniemy, OC for Kansas City, won Super Bowl on his way to trying to do it again. Mm-hmm. Everything I've, you know, you hear about this guy, he is head coach material, but still.
Yeah. I was surprised he didn't get a job last year. That was, you know.
And now this year looks like it won't be happening either. But that's, we digress. Mm-hmm. While we have our veteran NFL mom here, I have to ask. Geno did well. Pro Bowl caliber player. 11 years. I know this past season, he had surgery. Season-ending surgery. So now as he comes into like 11 years in the league, same team, it's crazy to me. At what point is he starting to think about retirement, and what does his life after football look like?
Yeah, just playing with the Bengals and just the losing that we've had for the last couple of years, it weighs on you, because at one point, you know, even in the season last year, he was like, I'm done. And I'm like, really? Are you done? Are you not going to go chase the ring? We got to chase the ring. And he was like, nope, I'm good, you know. And I was like, so he says, he comes back this year and, you know, he hurts his shoulder actually in August. And they, you know, he tries to rest it for 6 weeks and then come back. But the tear is still there. So we know he has to have surgery. And he kind of plays it out through the season. And then he had the surgery on the 29th of December. But it just wears on you. Wears on you mentally where you're in that kind of environment all the time. So, you know, I told him, I said, look, let's do this. If, you know, the Bengals want you to come back, fine. I said, but if not, I said, you just hang out until September. Somebody need an old D-tackle to get one or two sacks. And I said, you can, at that point, you can pick and choose where you want to go. You know, you say, hey, and I say, you go to a contender and try to win a playoff game. We have never won a playoff game in 11 years. I said, you at least want to do that. So I'm trying to talk him into at least another 2 years.
Maybe he may be that guy that want to just finish his career off as a Bengals.
He is. He's a loyalist. He, you know, is very, whatever he gets, he keeps his things. He has things at my house now and I'm like, I'm throwing it out. He's like, no, I'm coming to get it. You know, because I told, when he was getting ready to get married, I told his wife, I'm like, he's a keeper. Whatever he gets, he keeps it.
So he met his wife, Kristen Merritt, in college, right? What advice did you give him about women, about girls when he was, you know, up and coming from even high school, college to pros? Because I know why they got married 2016. So going on 5 years.
Yeah. He, you know, I saw the girls that were hanging around. And at the time, Facebook had just come into, you know, college students were on Facebook. So I joined Facebook as a college student. I was Miss Sandy Watkins. I mean, not very original.
No, you didn't.
And I went to FIU, which is Florida International University. I had made a whole profile.
No, you didn't.
As a college student, and I was all his friends' friends. At that point, they were just everybody. Anybody sent a friend request, they were just, so I would just kind of see how these people operate on Facebook and see these girls and the ones. And I'm like, that one there.
What was your name? Sandy Watkins.
That was my Facebook alias, and I was just, you know, just seeing how they operate, and they on there cussing, and they, you know, just carrying on. And I'm like, wow,
you're okay. Like they cussing.
Oh yeah, they were just, you know, some of the ones, and I was like, okay, that girl right there.
Now this is not the Facebook of today. This was Facebook.
That was
of
the college
the
student Facebook.
When he
started that in the dorm room in Harvard, it was primarily for college students to communicate. And so that's what they did. And so this was 2006, 7, 8, 9. And I was their friends. And I would just kind of check out the girl's profile. You know, some of them had family pictures. Some of them, I remember one girl, And I was like, she had like seven brothers and sisters. I'm like, oh no, there's too many families, too many brothers and sisters to deal with right here, honey. Mm-mm, no, 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 no. So I would look at all those things. I'm like, nope, this one right here, nope. She cussing online. Mm-mm, no, can't do that.
No, this one is harder now, though. It's harder now because they have Instagram. And the thing is, they're all in the DMs, and you can't get in the DMs.
I'll just be looking.
I'll be like, really? Do you have to like that many? You know, just looking at. Facebook was much easier to track them, but now Instagram is like a menu.
Yeah, so I just told him, you know, just whatever, you know, I said, whatever you choose, choose wisely. I said, you all know, because we, you know, his dad and I got divorced when he was 11 years old. And so, you know, I told him, I said, you know how hard the divorce was on you guys, so you don't want to put your kids through that. So always, you know, just choose wisely. And so that was my key to him. And then when he met Kristen, they were friends for about 2 years. And then when he got out and got into the league, he was like, I got a 5-year plan. I'm not marrying nobody for 5 years. And he didn't. He kept his 5-year plan. And I was like, what are y'all doing? You know,
did he say why?
He just said he had, I guess if she hung in there for 5 years, then she was really, you know, really want to be there. So I was like, okay, then. So he married her after 5 years.
So he did like you. He left college with a degree and a future wife.
Yep, he did. Yep, he did. And they, she was a nurse. She's a nurse. She worked as a nurse in Georgia. And so she would come up for the games, go back home, come up, you know. So, because I don't play that living together before you're married stuff. That's just, you know, playing house.
Come on, come on.
I know, I'm old school.
He grown. Yeah. He grown. You old school.
I'm old school. I'm like, ain't no need to, you know, you whatever. Y'all can do back and forth, do your thing. So they did that. And the rest this history. Now I have 2 grandchildren. So that's
yes,
awesome.
The little girl was born, you know, I was like November.
November 9th. Yeah. She was 5 weeks early. She surprised everybody. So it's like, okay, I know what this one going to do to us. And my grandson will be 2 next Saturday. So I'll probably head up to it. They're actually relocating. They're going to be in Atlanta. They want to live in Atlanta. So you just want to be in Georgia. You want to be where everybody knows your name, right? And he's like, no, Florida's just too hot. And, you know, y'all don't have any seasons. I say, y'all. I say, you are Floridian. I guess you're not a Floridian anymore, right? So, yeah.
So I'm going to make you right now our commissioner, right? You're going to be the commissioner right now. You're 11 years in the league. What has the league done right? What does the league need to do better?
What they've done right, I think, you know, protecting the players, you know, changing some of the rules with a lot of the hits that were glorified back in the day. Like I said, my husband was a hard hitting safety. That was his mantra. He was Mean Gene. And he would hit. He would hit you and your helmet would fly off and roll down the field. And that Monday Night Football would show it over and over again. And everybody in the stands would go wild. So that was glorified in football. Now that's a 15-yard penalty and you may get to go to the locker room.
And your money.
and your money.
Your check would be light.
Will be light. So
your check would be light.
Yeah. So I see that at the NCAA level. And so, you know, the guys, because you have to learn how, you have to change your play. And so I think starting at the NCAA, you'll see that, you know, you won't see a lot of those penalties anymore. So that's one of the things that they've done right. As far as the way they handle the entire trying to get inclusion and when Colin Kaepernick did, you know, his protest, the way they handled that, they were on the wrong side of history in that. And it will go down to show, you know, that they, whoever they have at the table, that's African-American, which, you know, we get some of them there and they get to the table and they don't tell the truth because they're trying to keep their little job. So they kind of acclimate, yeah. You know, I've said, you can't do that. If they bring you to the table, they're bringing you to the table to let them know what's up.
And you're
not doing that. But some of them have been removed from the neighborhood for so long. They don't know. They don't deal with their family members. They don't. So they either don't know or they don't, you know, they're trying to.
They haven't been to the cookout in a long
time.
That's
it. And so, okay. You know, they should know that's, you know, and then when they came out with their policy in the beginning, it's like, we're going to play the Negro National Anthem. It's like, why?
Oh,
why? What is that going to do?
They're always table dressing.
Yeah.
Never saying, let's dismantle the system and build back better.
You know, so that was one of the things I think that they, you know, got wrong.
We're going to have Snoop Dogg come rap for y'all.
You know, just, you know, crazy. We're hiring Jay-Z to do the music and just, you know, things that are superficial. Nothing that's really, you got your owner.
It's all condescending though. It's like, we're going to pacify you. Okay. Are they calm now? Okay. Then let's go back to what we've always done.
Yeah. And you know, like I said, you have people that own these teams that are ingrained. Their entire existence has been ingrained in suppression and and, you know, inequality. That's their world. And that's all they know. And they've taught it to their children, who's going to take over these teams. So until you start with these owners and getting some diversity training, you know, with them, not just, oh, I'm going to hire a black guy. I got a black guy here. I hired him. And what? Your mind and your heart is still the same. You haven't changed, you know, your heart. You haven't, you know, you don't have a heart for this. And so
they ain't even hiring the black head coaches. And but, so okay.
That's one of the things I think that, you know, has to happen. We have to have, you know, our ownership group. We have to get together and said, hey, look each other in the eye. And this is a problem until we, you know, even when the other day when they had all this happen and Joe Biden got on TV and said, this is not who we are. And I'm like, stop.
I'm like, where you been? You're like 800 years old.
Yeah, stop it. This is who we are. And if you say that this is who we are, then you can change. You can start the change. But it, don't say that this is not who we are.
Because it's almost like, have you been living in on a different planet because the rest of us? Because this is exactly.
This is exactly who we are.
Who we are. And if we want to go further and unite and heal, then we have to tell the truth.
We have to acknowledge
it. And accountability has to be number one.
Yeah. And I tell them, we're not gonna go crazy if you acknowledge it. We already know. We just need you to acknowledge it. So we can say, how do we change it? Because you can't change something unless you acknowledge it. And that's what I think. So I think the NFL as a whole going forward, like I said, it's a big money machine. And I knew that, you know, this year they put those players' health in jeopardy. Just thank God nobody, you know, wife or kids passed away or a player passed away. We had some adverse effects.
I think we're no more in 5 years. You know what I mean? It just was like, because the protocols with the players and it was just... They got the season off, but it was just like, this is a whole pandemic. And then Jerry Jones bragging about having the most fans all season.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Okay,
and Texas is reeling. So, you know, that those are some of the things. But I think, like I said, protecting the player's safety on the field with, you know, the big hits. I think that was, you know, they're not gladiators. That was that old gladiator mentality. We stand and we cheer as the gladiators come out and kill each other. Let's get out of that. Play the game, you know, play it safely. And then basically just deal with the inequality that's in the game. We have to do that.
Yeah.
You can't have 70% of your whatever it is you got. You know, I got $70, you got $30, but $30 is trying to control the $70. Come on. You know, let's equal it, the playing field a little bit.
You know, and I hope that the players also start to use their voice in that manner. And in defense, you know, Roger Goodell, the commissioner, Troy Vincent, who are executive director, it starts with the owners, though. Those are the decision makers. Those 32 owners, they are the ones who, you know, have to find a way to put the pressure on them. Okay, so quickly, Gino, I mean, now that you can breathe easier, right? Looking back at his career, what are your proudest moments when you look back?
The first thing I think about is, you know, the way he came out and played his second and third year. I mean, he was like lights out. I was like, I didn't even know he could play that good. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, it's like, ooh, you know, and it's like Gino. And then when I saw his jersey in the stands for the first time, the people walking around with 97, and I'm like, and Atkins, and I'm like, you know, that for the first time, that's something that gives you a jolt because it didn't happen his rookie year. It didn't happen the second year. The third year, the jerseys were everywhere, and we're at an away game, and I'm walking down the street, and this guy's walking with Atkins on, and I, you know, I'm just walking, you know, like, okay, you know, and sometimes, you know, you want to say, yeah, I'm his mama. But you just keep walking and be humble.
Because if somebody says something sideways, you don't want to, you know what I mean? The Lord has not given me a prison ministry.
Yeah. Yes, you know, so it was one of the, you know, the proudest moments, just seeing his jersey on, you know, all over the state, you know, the stadium. And then, you know, playing those, you know, really great that second and third year. And then they went in and said after the third year, hey, we want to redo your contract. And we were like, yes, that's that second contract. It came a year early, we'll take it. And so he signed that contract. And, you know, when he signed it, you know, some guys signed the big deal and then they just kind of fall off the cliff. They get their money and they stop playing. He really excelled, you know, to play even better and then signed another contract as a 30-year-old, which was, you know, unheard of. He signed, you know, another deal as a 30-year-old. So that was, you know, awesome because he didn't, you know, they didn't give him the money. He decided not to play. So he got it and he went out there and still did his job at a high level. And so, and that's my thing with him. If you can't do the game at a high level anymore, then son, retire. You have done this game owes you nothing. You owe it nothing. You know, retire and see if we can get to the Hall of Fame with the stats you have. I said, but you need a playoff win.
Hey, this might be the year they get that playoff win. With Joey Burrow coming back healthy and strong and the Bengals seems to be putting together a solid defense, this might be their year. I love how unfiltered and frank Sandra Atkins is, or her alias, Sandy Watkins, who she made up so she can follow her son on Facebook and watch who he was befriending, especially the ladies, and how Gina was not going to get linked up with a girl with seven siblings. That was not happening. Anyway, when you come from a place of truth, you really don't need a filter. One of my favorite parts of the whole interview was Gino choosing Georgia for the food and the comfy bed. Like, what else do you need in life but good food and a nice bed? Gino playing with sickle cell made Sandra his stand-in doctor mom. I love how she sits behind the defense bench and watches to make sure her son is okay. Our son's physical and mental health are everything to us. Their mental health, even more important. Which brings me to today's Annie's Clapback. Today's Annie's Clapback is not a clapback, but more a tribute to the spirit of Bryce Gowdy, the young man, football star at Deerfield Beach High School, on his way to play ball at Georgia Tech when he took his own life. This story really touched me, and even now it still touches me. But it really tugged at my heart so much so that I felt the need to fly from New Jersey to Florida January of 2020 to attend his funeral. And I thank Sandra for coming with me. Because we are all football moms, whether your kids play in high school, college, or the pros. When one of us hurts, all of us hurt. Bryce was such a sweet soul and a light. A bright light gone too soon, but never forgotten. Thanks to the work of his mom and the Bryce Gowdy Foundation addressing the issues of mental health and young people, especially athletes. Rest easy, sweet Bryce. All that's left for me to say right now is thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it. Raising the Pro is part of the Audio Boom Originals Network. If you haven't already done so, please don't forget to hit that follow button on your podcast app so you don't miss any new episodes. See you next time, family.